You're listening to Around Noon on 90.3. I'm Dee Perry, and this is the show for Thursday, September 10th. Today, we welcome the 2009 winners of the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards. Later, listen for a young writer with a direct connection to Vietnam, a scholar of the Sally Hemings family, and a Lifetime Achievement winner who traveled the nation with Langston Hughes. But first, a little love medicine. The stories of Louise Erdrich are stories of the Dakotas, where love is a treasured yet mysterious thing. Her tales tell of passionate love, family love, and love of nation, the Native American nation. Louise Erdrich takes her place as one of the two fiction winners for this year's Annisfield Wolf Book Awards on stage tonight at the Cleveland Playhouse. The award is given each year here in Cleveland to writers who exemplify not only an understanding of the injustice of racism, but possibly more importantly, the beauty of diversity. In her books like Love Medicine, Tracks, and now The Plague of Doves, Erdrich spans the lives of Native American families and their relationships with those on and off the reservation. I'm very pleased to welcome Louise Erdrich here to Idea Center at Playhouse Square. Louise, hello.
Hi, thank you. Well, it's good to be here.
It's good to have you. And congratulations, I should say.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to start with the fact that a passion for reading connects most writers, but really does connect you and fellow winner Nam Lee. He's admitted his debt to the many books he's read, and you actually own a bookstore in your home state of Minnesota. How did you come to do that?
Yes, I do. It's called Birchbark Books, and I started it with my daughters, and we started it because we'd seen small bookstores going under all over, and we loved them so much. So we wanted to start something. We had no idea how to do it. We wanted to have a bookstore cat. That was our... We never did get a cat. We ended up with a parakeet. But we began to put this bookstore together, and then people began to come as though drawn by the gravity of what we were doing, the love of books, the love of eccentricity. You know, book people are so independent and eccentric and wonderful.
And so is that the kind of book that your store specializes in, the eccentric, the offbeat?
Well, not exactly. We really look for what our customers want, and we have a wonderful array. We center our bookstore, however, on Native American books, so that you go online to our bookstore site at Birchbark Books, and you would find that we really have the best we can find in contemporary Native fiction, history, literature, and that's where our concentration lies. But we're a general bookstore as well.
And I would imagine your own books would be on the shelves prominently, just because that is your area of expertise in terms of what you've written about.
Well, I signed them, so that kind of gives us an edge.
There you go. What are some of the books that you read early on that made a real impact on you, that maybe made you think, yes, this is something I want to do?
Well, you know, I was looking through the past winners of the Annisfield Wolf Book Award, and I came across Vine Deloria Jr. And his books, God Is Red, and his all of his other work, really, Custer Died for Your Sins, those books were formative for me. So I was thrilled to be within this long-standing company.
And you yourself come from both Native American and European heritage. Tell us something about your family background and how it's come to impact your writing.
My father is German-American, and my mother is Chippewa, Ojibwe, or Anishinaabe. Those are all words for the same group of people. So I belong to the Turtle Mountain Chippewa, Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, and my background is Pembina Band. And I guess you'd say I have memories of my grandfather, and I try to keep learning the language he spoke, which is Ojibwe or Anishinaabemowin. And I speak with my daughters at home. You know, it's an ongoing life. It's very cultural, you know, that the way that anyone participates in their culture. We go to powwows, or we just sit home and do whatever anybody does. You know, it's not as though people live in that much differently.
Yeah,
but we have a different cultural identity, I suppose, mm-hmm. that's mixed with German and with Chippewa.
But it's good that you're maintaining those ties as opposed to sort of just saying, well, that was the past.
Well, I think because my mother has such a strong identity, and I was raised with her influence, and of course she's still a great influence on us, that my brothers and sisters, as well as I, have a strong tie to our community. I was educated partly because of my background. I went to Dartmouth College partly because of my background. So that this tie has shaped my life, really.
And as we mentioned, your writing, your early books like Love, Medicine, and Tracks focus on Native American families such as the Nanapush and Kashpaw
mm-hmm.
Clans. I want to have you talk about creating those fictional family trees and the reservation where their stories unfold.
Well, I wanted to make a universe that people who were of any Native background could identify with. But it also is within its own tribal nation a universe, because there's many, many different branches of Ojibwe, Chippewa, Anishinaabe, so that this reservation is a sort of fictionalized version of an Ojibwe reservation. But what I see now is what I see is happening now is so fascinating and wonderful to me, because we're suddenly seeing the fruits of so many writers beginning to write out of their own tribal nations, their own national origins, really, so that we have Sherman Alexie and Linda Hogan and so many other Native American writers coming out with wonderful books.
Many of your books are set in North Dakota, and I wanted to sort of explore your connection to that part of the country.
I grew up in North Dakota, and I live not too far from North Dakota. I live about 3 hours from the border, and I have to get back there every so often. I have family there still. I suppose that if I hadn't happened to have my daughters in the bookstore and everybody fall in love with Minneapolis, I would have gone back to North Dakota. I love the plains.
And you set your latest novel, The Plague of Doves, in North Dakota as well. It centers on Evelina Harp and her beloved grandfather, Mushum. Tell us about those two.
Mushum is based really on, it's really based on a number of elders who I've loved and who have cared about me over the years. People with senses of humor and kindness and this old form of generosity that I think it's wonderful to pass down to children. And it's very particular to our elders, I think, in many of our communities. But to me, the sense that Mushum has of his own history is a wonderful thing. He's always expounding on what would have happened and what, you know, how things would be different. And involving his children and his grandchildren in stories of his youth. And they're not always, sometimes he's making them up, but they're listening to stories about Mustache Maud, for instance, which she really was a character in North Dakota history. She was a wrestler, Mustache Maud. So I brought her into the book, too.
Would you share a passage from the book with us?
I will, and I'd like to dedicate this little passage to so many parents who are bringing their children to college for the first time. It's quite an experience, and in this book I remember back to how it was for me. In the fall of 1972, my parents drove me to college. Everything I needed was packed in a brand new royal blue aluminum trunk. We carried the trunk up two flights of stairs, and dread invaded me. In spite of my determination to go, for instance, as far as Paris, I had actually dreaded leaving home, even to go as far as the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. And in the end, my parents didn't want me to go either, but I had to go, and here I was. We walked back down the stairs. I was too miserable to cry, and I do not remember our final embraces, but I watched my mother and father as they stood beside the car. They waved to me, and that moment is a clear, still picture. My father, so thin and athletic, looked almost frail with shock, while my mother, whose beauty was still remarkable and who was known on the reservation for her silence and reserve, had left off her characteristic gravity. Her face and my father's face were naked with love. It wasn't something that we talked about, love, and I was terrified of its expression from the lips of my parents. But they allowed me this one clear look at it. Their love blazed from them. And then they left. I think now that everything that was concentrated in that one look, their care in raising me, their patient lessons in every subject they knew to teach, their wincing efforts to give me freedoms, their example of fortitude and work, allowed me to survive myself.
That's beautiful. And those are the words of Louise Erdrich, 2009 fiction winner for the Annisfield Wolf Book Award, reading from her acclaimed novel, The Plague of Doves. Tonight, Louise and her fellow winners are on stage at the Cleveland Playhouse for the annual Annisfield Wolf Ceremony. And as we mentioned earlier, Louise, this award is given to writers who celebrate diversity and unveil the evils of racism. What does it mean to you to get this award tonight?
This award is an enormous honor for me. I knew of it as a very prestigious award that was. I always thought of the other people who received it as having done something very important, especially in our country, where we really strive so hard in our national ideal to become unified and yet celebrate the mosaic of who we are. So I think this award is a particularly American award, and I'm so thrilled to be here because of it.
And we are thrilled to have you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Louise Erdrich, the 2009 Annisfield Wolf Book Award winner for fiction. Tonight, she takes home that award in a ceremony at the Cleveland Playhouse. And to find out more about the awards and this year's winners, you can log on to our homepage online at WCPN.org, where you can hear today's show on demand and comment on what you hear. Coming up, we meet a young writer who's made quite the debut with his acclaimed collection of short stories, The Boat. Nam Lee joins us as you stay tuned to Around Noon here on 90.3 Idea Stream.
This is 90.3 WCPN. Idea Stream.
Welcome back. You're tuned to a special edition of Around Noon as we spotlight this year's winners of the Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. While we're paying tribute to our next winner with music from his family's homeland of Vietnam, the stories of Nam Le's acclaimed collection, The Boat, take us on a journey that actually spans the globe, both as setting and metaphor. Opening his book is like traveling on a mystical boat taking us to Colombia, Iowa, Australia, Japan, and of course, Vietnam. The Boat has received rave reviews for its language and its tone, which in the pages of the New York Times places Nam Le in the company of literary heavyweights. That'll be the case tonight as the youngest member of this year's Anisfield Wolf Book Award class of winners. Joining me now in Studio 4 of Idea Center at Playhouse Square is Nam Le. Nam, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me today.
Your parents moved from Vietnam when you were just a year old, settling in Australia. I wanted to have you describe the setting of your life and what it was like to grow up Asian Australian.
It was all I knew, and so it was completely normal for me. I grew up in a suburb for most of my early childhood years where I went to a primary school and I was the only Asian bloke there. And it was exactly right because it was all I knew. And when I went to high school, I had many Asian friends from different places. And, you know, there is always that undertow of difference. But of course, that undertow can be expressed and can move you in so many different ways and from so many different directions. And so that was just one of many ways in which I felt estranged in perhaps not a negative way, but certainly, you know, other than what a lot of my friends were going through. But I'm sure that at the time, I felt that they were going through the same thing based on different differences.
Right. Exactly. Somehow I've come to the conclusion that everybody feels like an outsider and a loner, even as everybody else views them as,
I reckon,
as part
so.
Of the inside.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're all part of many minorities, you know. And
Did you feel like your appetite for reading led to your appetite for writing?
I think absolutely. I think that was, you know, when I was young, my parents used to drop me off at the library in the morning, and that used to be my surrogate childcare. They would just leave me there all day. And at the end of the day, I'd come out with, you know, two armfuls of books and would just devour them. I loved reading. And
did you have a preference for the kinds of things, or were you just all over the board?
I think at the start, I loved reading fairy tales for the most part. And there are all these wonderful series, you know, the Book of Magicians, the Book of Dragons, the Book of Witches, and I would just plow through those. And then I discovered, you know, Grimm and Christian Andersen and would read those. And from there, I got very interested in science fiction and fantasy. But, you know, the libraries that I used to attend were quite small. And so on the shelves, you'd have what would be children's fiction and then literary fiction and classic poetry and, you know, all sorts of stuff just cheek by jowl. And so I loved just, you know, moving in a very unarranged way from book to book.
I like that. You said that your parents are the biggest inspiration of your life. I wanted to have you talk about them and how they inspired you.
You know, inspiration is a tricky thing, and it's very difficult to follow, I guess, for myself anyway, the nexus between any given experience or stimulus and how it actually comes out creatively. But I can say that it still stuns me every time I think about it, to turn my mind to what my parents went through, to think of them as not just my parents, but as people in their own right, as sons and daughters and brothers and you know, professional people and lovers. And to have that run through my head and sort of map the story of their lives, what part of it I know, onto the actual incidences of history and of situation and place,
Did they talk at all about the decision to go from Vietnam to Australia, why they made that choice?
I think that's one of the reasons why it carries so much charge for me, is because they didn't really speak about it, except in very general terms. Mm. You know, the terms of wanting to provide a better opportunity for their children, wanting to give them a good education, which sound completely dry and pedestrian when they say it like that. But then, when you map it onto where they were, what was happening, it's mind-blowing for me.
Yeah. And you said that you haven't decided about your connection to Vietnam, and you're okay with that.
Yeah, I'm very advertent to the fact that because I have a certain name, a certain background, a certain platform, I guess, and I look a certain way, that there is an expectation in the world, in the literary community in particular, that I'll deliver a certain type of narrative in a certain way. And I guess I've always resisted the idea of having my limitations set out for me. I think I have, you know, plenty of limitations of my own that I should be able to marshal and manage. So part of the provocation, I guess, of a lot of what I write is a resistance to that pigeonholing. But by the same token, there's a reason why certain material is so charged to me, and there's a reason why my own heritage and background plays such a large role in my everyday treating with how I am and who I am. And so I feel very much that I, like any writer, should be able to make the case on the page, should be able to write about whatever I want and be judged by what I write rather than who I am. And so my relationship with Vietnam feeds into that ambivalence, I guess, you know, or that ambiguity. I'm okay with not knowing exactly how it registers and resonates with me, but I guess I've got a long time to try to figure that out.
Yeah. And having set it up like that, now would be a perfect time to hear you read something from the book, if you would.
Oh, cheers, of course. Well, seeing as we're speaking about Vietnam, I'll read the part from the title story, which is you know, the Vietnamese subject matter story, I guess. It's called The Boat. The storm came on quickly. The crosswind surged in, filtering through the apertures in the rotten wood, sounding like a chorus of low moans. The boat began to rock. Hugging a beam at the top of the hatch, Mai looked out and her breath stopped. The boat had heeled so steeply that all she saw was an enormous wall of black-green water bearing down. She shut her eyes, opened them again. Now the gunwale had crested the water, the ocean completely vanished, and it was as though they were soaring through the air, the sky around them dark and inky and shifting. A body collided into hers, slammed her against the side of the hatch door. The boat righted, and she slipped again, skidding in jets of water down the companionway. The hatch banged shut. Other bodies, she was on top of them, thighs and ribs and arms and heads jammed this way and that with each groaning tilt, writhing toward space as though impelling the boat to heave too, back into the wind. The rocking got worse. Light was failing fast now, and inside the hold it had become uncannily dim. Finally, the storm arrived in force. The remaining light drained out of the hold. Wind screamed through the cracks. She felt the panicked limbs, people clawing for direction, sudden slaps of ice-cold water, the banging and shapeless shouts from the deck above. The whole world reeled. Everywhere the stink of vomit, her stomach forced up, squashed through her throat. So this was what it was like, she thought, the moment before death.
The words of Nam Lee, the 2009 fiction winner for the Anisfield Wolf Book Award, and he was reading from his acclaimed collection, The Boat. Tonight, he takes home his award in a ceremony that's on at the Cleveland Playhouse. Beautiful writing, but also it in a way demonstrates the sort of research you must have had to do to create this book. And I wanted to have you talk about that, because I'm curious if you went to the places that you write about too, like Colombia, like Tehran.
Right. haven't been to all of those places. I have been to some places, but I guess my thinking about this is, even had I been to the places, like Japan, for example, or Colombia, which I have been to, it's still very fair, I think, and instructive for me to say that I wouldn't have been to the places as they're depicted in the book. Part of that is just historical. I wasn't there in 45 before the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima. But also, it speaks to how inseparable the world is from the subjectivity that sees that world. And so I'm writing from the points of view of very particular characters in very particular situations. And the world that they see, the Tehran that they see, the Colombia they see, even the Iowa that the character with my name sees in that story, is very, very different to the places that I visit myself.
Speaking of Iowa, you studied at the famed Iowa Writers' Workshop. What sort of experience was that for you? Did you feel that it shaped you as a writer?
I feel that it gave me an amazing chunk of time and space to write. I was coming from full-time work in Australia, and I was also coming from a failed novel. And so coming to Iowa and having that freedom to muck around and to try reading new things and writing new things and being taken seriously, that was the greatest gift of all.
And you are certainly taken seriously now. I'm curious about what's next. Are short stories the medium you are most drawn to, or is there a novel in there somewhere?
Well, as I said, I started writing and reading poetry until maybe 7 or 8 years ago, and then I tried writing a novel, which many years and many pages later.
Yeah, I guess I should say later. Another novel in there.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm the last person that wants to read that novel, so I can't imagine what it would be like for other readers. But right now I am working on another novel, and I'm completely intrigued and challenged by the form.
Very good. We'll all look forward to seeing that. And in the meantime, thank you for this work. And congratulations, by the way, on your award.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Nam Lee, the 2009 fiction winner for the Annisfield Wolf Book Award, and he won for his acclaimed collection of short stories, The Boat. Tonight, he takes home his award in a ceremony that's on stage at the Cleveland Playhouse. For more on the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards and all of this year's winners, log on to our homepage online at WCPN.org, where you can hear the show on demand and comment on what you hear. Up next, the story of Sally Hemings and her family, Thomas Jefferson and his family, as we welcome nonfiction winner Annette Gordon Reed. You'll hear that as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3. You're tuned to a special edition of Around Noon, celebrating the winners of the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards for 2009. My next guest is the recipient of the award's nonfiction prize for her in-depth study of the relationship between the families of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson, titled The Hemingses of Monticello. She is Annette Gordon Reed, a professor of history at Rutgers University and a professor of law at New York Law School. She is also the winner of a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award for her work on The Hemingses of Monticello. Annette, welcome to Around Noon and congratulations on all of your awards.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
I was reading that your interest in Thomas Jefferson and later Sally Hemings began when you were a child, and I want to have you explain what sparked that interest.
Well, I read a child's biography of Jefferson when I was in the third grade, and I was interested in the idea of someone who loved books as much as I loved books, someone who had also this sort of contradiction at the heart of his life, that he wrote the Declaration of Independence, and he was also a slave owner. And for a young person, seeing that, you sort of wonder how could that be? What's going on here? So he was a figure of fascination for me, and then I learned about the Hemings family later on.
Did you read a lot of history when you were younger, or was it a wider spread palette for you as a reader?
Oh, I think I tried to read everything that I could. I grew up in a small town in Texas, and there was not that much to do. So the Montgomery County Public Library was a place to hang out. And so I read lots of history, but I also read lots of fiction and novels as well. It was more reading than anything else that really attracted me.
And you followed your interest in Jefferson and Hemings over the years, researching for a book almost a dozen years ago, I guess. Well, maybe it is a dozen years ago, in 1997, Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy. How was that book received by other Jefferson scholars at the time it was published?
Well, at the time it was published, I got a better response than I thought I was going to get. I thought I would get much more hostility, but there were some people who were still sort of upset with the idea that Jefferson may have had an affair with Sally Hemings, some sort of relationship with Sally Hemings. But the book was really about, in my mind, the difference in the way the words of black people were received in history as opposed to the words of white people. So the subject of Jefferson and Hemings was interesting, but it was really the larger question of how do you receive the words of enslaved people? And I thought that they were being shortchanged. And so I think that added sort of a charge to all of it in a way, sort of an electrical charge to it, that people were not being fair in their assessment of this story.
And you've continued telling that story, but expanded it in a really large way with this latest book. I wanted to have you explain the span of time and the span of family that you cover.
Well, it's a very, very big family. People had big families in the 18th century. The span of time really is 1735 until 1826. It began in 1735 because that's when Elizabeth Hemings, Sally Hemings' mother, was born. And so she is really the matriarch of the clan. She had 14 children, 12 who lived to become adults, and then they had children. And so there's a big cast of characters. I have a family tree to try to help the reader along because they named one another after their siblings and so forth. So it can get kind of confusing. But so it spans a great amount of time, but it's really the time, the focus is on when the Hemingses are at Monticello from 1772 up until 1826 when Jefferson dies, and 135 people are sold, some of them Hemingses. When Jefferson dies bankrupt and his property has to be disposed of by auction.
And when you say the name Monticello, they immediately think, oh, the palatial home of Thomas Jefferson. What did you want to get across by titling the book The Hemingses of Monticello?
That it was their place too, that ownership of a place is not just about legal ownership. It is a place where you have your families and your connections, where you are born, where you raise your children, where you bury your family. And I want people to think of them when you think of Monticello as much as you think of him. I mean, obviously we think of him as a public figure, but the place where he lived was the place where the Hemingses lived. Many of them spent much more time there than he actually did because he was away quite a bit. So I want people to see the Hemingses as part of that place as well. And I'm very happy that seems to be what people are doing.
Yeah. And the Hemings had a large role in running Monticello and in making sure that this place was supported. It was their labor that kept it going.
Absolutely. Part of their labor, many of members of the Hemings family were house servants. They were also the artisans at Monticello, John Hemings, who was the master carpenter. If you go to Monticello today, you can see some of his handiwork still there. This is a place that they were connected to. And as you said, they helped run it, and it was part of their lives, and it should be part of the American story. So that's why the Hemings is a Monticello and an American family, that this is
right.
The story of this family, but it's also, you can see the story of lots of African-American families who began life in slavery and endured until this point.
That is the voice of Annette Gordon-Reed, the multi-award-winning author of The Hemingses of Monticello. She's in town for tonight's award ceremony for the Cleveland-based literary prize, the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards, and she joins me in Studio 4 of Idea Center for today's Around Noon. And Annette, you write in amazing detail about the relationships and the daily activities of the Hemings, the Wales, the Jefferson, among many others. What sorts of documents did you gain access to that let you fill in so many blanks?
Well, Jefferson was an inveterate record keeper. He had a farm book in which he kept the listing of all of the enslaved people at Monticello. Other planters did this as well. Slavery was a business, so he kept track of his inventory, who was born, what their names were, where they were living. He also kept a memorandum book when he would say, if you went out to Starbucks and you bought a cappuccino, you'd come back to your house and write down, went to Starbucks, cappuccino, $3.60 or whatever. And he did that every day from the time he was in his 20s up until the time he died in his 80s. And that record, it's over 1,000 pages, a couple of thousand pages, has many, many references to the Hemingses. So you can sort of track members of that family through his memorandum books. He had about 17,000 letters that he wrote, and they very often mention members of the Hemings family. So, and also the Hemingses, some of them were literate. So we have some of their letters, the family history of the Hemingses, Jefferson's records, all those kinds of things. Now, the difficulty is combing through all of it, and that's what took time.
Yeah, I bet. But there's also kind of a fascinating portrait that develops of Jefferson as this sort of ambivalent man when it comes to slavery. He would say things on one hand, but his actions on the other hand sort of contradicted things that he would say in terms of his feelings on the subject. And at the same time, it seemed like there was some ambiguity in the relationships and the feelings of the Hemings family towards him as well.
Yes, that's one of the things that makes him so fascinating. He is, well, in some ways a mirror to people in general. He had a set of intellectual beliefs that he emotionally could not, you know, fulfill. He couldn't follow through on. I do believe that he thought slavery was wrong. But slavery was a part of his life. He tells the story of his first memory of being handed up on a pillow to a slave when he's about 3 years old to make a trip. And when he died, his grandson says that on his deathbed, he says something and nobody in the room knows what he's talking about except for Burl Colbert, who was Sally Hemings' nephew, and he was Jefferson's manservant. And so Burl is the only person who knew what he was saying, and he raises him on his pillow because that's what he wants to have happen. And then he falls asleep, and then he never wakes up. So his first memory is of that of a slave, and the last one as well. So he has an intellectual belief, but this is his life. And he did not have, you could say, the discipline or whatever, the wherewithal to really rid himself and to separate himself from the thing that he had known from the time he was born.
And speaking of hard to separate, the Hemings family was intricately tied to Thomas Jefferson's wishes, whims, whatever, during his lifetime. You mentioned how they were affected by his death in 1826.
Yes. Well, Jefferson, the one thing that I should say here, that Jefferson's wife, Martha, was Sally Hemings' half-sister. So when Jefferson married and his wife's father died, the Hemingses came under his ownership. So there is a set of six siblings who are his wife's half-siblings who were treated very, very differently from other members of the Hemings family, including Sally Hemings, the youngest. Those people, all of those people either had been freed or became free in some way after Jefferson's death. There were other members of the family, you know, collateral relatives and so forth. They actually went up on the auction block. Jefferson freed a man named Joe Fawcett, who was a grandson of Elizabeth Hemings. But he didn't free the wife. Mm-hmm. And his children were sold at auction, and he actually arranged to buy some of them back. But one child, the man who promised to sell him back to him, reneged on the deal. And so the family spent years trying to convince him to do that, wasn't able to do that, and then he moves out to Ohio, Cincinnati, where he establishes himself as a blacksmith. The youngest son, there's sort of a happy ending to that story, eventually joins him in Ohio, and they become very active in the Underground Railroad. So, but again, there were other members of the family who were sold and scattered to the four winds, and we don't know where they are. I'm going to do a second volume of the book, of the saga of the Hemingses, and I'm going to try to figure some of that out. But there were very, very different responses, very different outcomes after Jefferson died.
Hmm. It's a fascinating story, and one that's intricately woven into the fabric of American history. Thank you for opening our eyes more.
Well, thank you for having me.
My guest has been Annette Gordon-Reed, and she is the multi-award-winning author of The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. She is also the winner of the nonfiction prize for the Anisfield Wolf Book Award. She'll receive that award this evening in a ceremony at the Cleveland Playhouse, and you can find out more about Annette Gordon-Reed and all of this year's Anisfield Wolf Award winners when you log on to the Around the Noon section of our homepage online at WCPN.org. Up next, a winner whose life's work is being honored tonight. Meet author Paul Marshall as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
This summer, you've told us your thoughts on topics like healthcare and the arts. Now it's your turn to tell us more.
This region faces the same challenges it has faced for many years, reinventing its economy.
Comments from you like this have led to local coverage like Facing the Mortgage Crisis. Become a part of the Listening Project. Take the newest survey online at WCPN.org. We're listening to you.
Welcome back to our special Anisfield Wolf Book Award broadcast of Around Noon. That ceremony is tonight at the Cleveland Playhouse, and my next guest is Paul Marshall, this year's winner of the Lifetime Achievement Award. Paul has published 5 widely acclaimed novels, including Brown Girl, Brown Stones, and earlier this year released her memoir, Triangular Road. Her influential writing has explored diverse perspectives and the mystery of identity while painting vivid portraits of her characters. In addition to writing, she's spread her insight through keynote speeches and as a distinguished chair at New York University. Paul, it's a pleasure to meet you, and thank you for coming.
Also, thank you.
Congratulations as well. What would you have said, do you think, if someone told you that you would be winning a Lifetime Achievement Award as you were writing your first novel, Brown Girl, Brown Stones?
Oh, I just would have been totally amazed because I didn't think I'd get past the first page of the novel.
Was that a difficult process, writing?
Well, writing has always been for me a difficult process because I'm so fussy about trying to find the exact right word. The words can elude you at times. But I was always, from very early on, still committed to the business of writing. Mm.
Were you an everyday writer once you got started, or did you get stuck waiting for that right word?
Oh, I could get stuck for sometimes a good week or two because the word just simply had to be right. And you just wait until it comes, or sometimes you pick it up from another book, but you know what you're seeking, and you sometimes simply have to wait for it to come to you. Mm. So I'm the slowest writer in the world.
Well, your parents are from Barbados. I wanted to have you talk about them and how the Caribbean might speak to you as a writer.
Well, they were like so many West Indians at the time, and this is we're talking of the early 1920s, the teens, when there was the movement, the migration of American blacks from the South, mm-hmm. from the cotton fields to the northern cities, Chicago, New York, and so on. There was at the same time as part of that movement, it's not really historically there, but it happened. You had people from the islands moving, finding a way of coming to the States. And so there was this part, they were part of that mass migration that we know so much, so well, that happened here. Well, my mother, she came first, and there was a way of getting here, because if you had a family member who went to work on the Panama Canal, which paid big money, that person then sent money back to the island home, and that money was used to send the others to England, to Canada, to America.
It strikes me that your book, Brown Girl, Brown Stones, it tells some of that story, not necessarily your story, but of a girl whose parents are from the island. She's growing up, or she's in Brooklyn, and I wondered how much you drew from your own life, how much of that hard work of writing was totally imaginary.
Well, it was partly the imagination, but also there was so much material there because I knew their background. For example, that my father, who desperately also wanted to leave this little tiny island of Barbados, but he did not go to Panama. Instead, he joined a labor scheme that sent men from the smaller islands to the larger ones, such as Cuba, where there was more work for them. And so my father, eager to leave this little tiny Barbados, signed up for the labor scheme and was sent to Cuba, doing the same thing he was doing in Barbados, cutting canes, sugar cane. And but there, he fell in love with all things Cuban. So our childhood was flavored with these few Cuban expressions and words that he remembered from his stay in Cuba. Well, he was still eager to get to the States. And so once, just as a kind of relief from the fields, he was sent with the sugar that was ready to be shipped to the port, to a port called Nuritas, I think. I'm mispronouncing it, I'm sure. But there he saw the ships the freighters that took the sugar to other parts of the world. He learned also that most of those freighters loaded down with sugar headed due north to the huge Domino sugar refinery in New York Harbor. That's all he needed to hear.
And the rest is her story.
He found a ship that And so he was an alien all his life. He was never able to, because he was a stowaway. Hmm. Got there safely, because it was a small West Indian community, met my mother, and there they are. There they were.
I would love to have you share some of your writing. Will you read something for us?
Yes, let me read something that has to do with another remarkable person in my life. Langston Hughes. He really, in a sense, became a mentor, a guide, a kind of treasured elder friend for me. He made sure that he attended my first book party. He was just so supportive that I received in the mail a letter from the State Department saying that Mr. Hughes was going to go on another State Department cultural tour, lecture tour in Europe. And he had said that he wasn't going to do it unless he could take with him a young emerging writer. There I was.
Emerging.
You know, but that was the kind of man he was, so willing to help the young writer, because I was simply in my apprenticeship at that point, even though I had just, the first book had just come out. And so he took me on this tour of Europe, I mean, this novice that I was. And so the portion I'd like to read is, we went all over Europe, and in the Danish capital, in Copenhagen. In the Danish capital of Copenhagen, Mr. Hughes as a night person. He was a night person. Eartha Kitt was a night person, you know. But Mr. Hughes was a true night person. He hung out all night, loved it. He took advantage of the pale blue Scandinavian white nights, recreating for me as he talked, because he talked all night, of the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s. The writers, musicians, painters, philosophers et al., who were among his circle of friends. Then there were the stories that he would tell me during these nights, these long blue nights, many of them of his travels around the world. Indeed, the poet had been a traveling man. Ever since he dropped out of Columbia University at age 19 and signed on as a mess boy on a freighter bound for Africa. And yes, he did actually throw his textbooks overboard, as has been said. The Big C, he would later write. Also, I Wonder as I Wander. Those were his two travel memoirs. I had read them as a teenager and had privately vowed, even back then, to follow his example. And not only would I become a writer, but a traveling woman as well.
Wonderful. The words of Paul Marshall. And that is from your recently published memoir.
Triangular Road.
I would love to spend actually the whole hour talking to you, but we are almost out of time. I just want to say congratulations, and it's such a privilege to have you in the studio and in town. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My guest has been Paul Marshall, the Lifetime Achievement winner for the 2009 Annisfield Wolf Book Award. Tonight, she accepts her award along with fellow winners Louise Erdrich, Nam Lee, and Annette Gordon-Reed in a ceremony at the Cleveland Playhouse, starting with a reception at 5:30. Now, while the ceremony is sold out, if you don't have a reservation, you're encouraged to attend the reception and get your name on the waiting list. For more on the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards and all this year's winners, log on to our homepage today online at WCPN.org, where you can hear the show on demand and comment on what you hear. Tomorrow around noon, we travel to Coal Country with a new documentary screening at the Akron Civic. For today, our thanks to KSU's David Badagnani for the musical suggestions heard on today's show. Thanks as well to Around Noon intern Danielle Sills and our technical producer Jeff Carlton, our executive producer Mark Rosenberger, and our producer Dave DiOrio. I'm Dee Perry. Good afternoon. Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana. Stop.